From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Bee colonies are on the decline.
Bees are the most abundant animal pollinators. In the absence of bees, there'd be much fewer plants setting seed, many fewer nuts and berries, fewer birds, fewer bears. The whole ecosystem would be impacted at some level.
Today we talk with biologist Lawrence Packer. His book, Keeping the Bees, is about the many threats facing bees, including pesticides, disease, and loss of habitat. And we learn about some amazing natural predators, like a beetle that uses pheromones to disguise its larvae and sneak them into bees' nests.
It's a bit like going to a bar and chatting somebody attractive up, and all of a sudden they turn into several hundred rat-sized parasites that you're forced to take home, and then they eat your children.
Also, David Bianculli reviews the new TV series Extant and The Strain, and Ken Tucker reviews the new album by Jim Lauderdale. First news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Every year, more than half the honeybee hives in the United States are taken to California to pollinate the state's almond crop. Our guest, biologist Lawrence Packer, says that fact illustrates both our dependence on honeybees to pollinate many plants we rely on for food and the devastating decline in the domestic honeybee population in recent years. As you'll hear, the loss of honeybees has been attributed to a variety of causes, from nasty parasites to the stress of being transported from state to state to feed on various crops in need of pollination. Lawrence Packer has spent his career studying bees, and he believes we'll be better off if we rely less on honeybees in managed hives for pollination and more on some of the 20,000 species of wild bees. Packer's new book is an exploration of bee pollination and a celebration of bee diversity, from stingless bees that feed on tears to others that survive by invading other bees' nests. Lawrence Packer is a professor of biology at York University in Toronto. He spoke to Fresh Air contributor Dave Davies about his book, Keeping the Bees, Why All Bees Are at Risk and What We Can Do to Save Them.
Well, Lawrence Packer, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you very much.
Let's start with some basics. I mean, we know that bees pollinate flowers, but remind us why bees are doing it and why it's important for so many plants.
Well, plants reproduce, flowering plants reproduce by pollen being transferred from the male part of the plant to the female part of a plant. And bees are the most abundant animal pollinators that that do this for the plants. So they visit plants for nectar and pollen. And they do this because the female bee has to collect nectar to fuel her own energies, and she eats some pollen to help her to develop eggs. But more importantly, those two plant products are used by bees as food for the next generation of bees. And so what bees do when they pollinate a plant is actually they're messy shoppers. They're leaving some part of the food that they have collected from the plant behind on the next flower that they visit. That is that's pollination by bees, but the bees actually want as much pollen and nectar as they can get to take it back home.
Right, so this critical function for reproducing plants and crops is essentially by bees being sloppy. They're not actually trying to deposit the pollen in the female part of the plant. It just slips off.
It just drops off. Yeah, normally the stigmas, the female parts of the plant, are a little sticky, and so that helps the pollen to be loosened from the surface of the bee.
Now, somebody said, I think this is a quote misattributed to Einstein, that if bees disappeared, humans would have only 4 years of life left. That's apparently an exaggeration, but give us a sense of what plants rely on bees for pollination.
Well, for example, watermelon, a nice economically valuable watermelon that's large and quite round, not malformed, requires a couple of thousand pollen grains to be deposited. And that might require seven or so different visits of a bee to the flower. And in California, where these studies have been done in the most detail, there are 40 different species of bees that will perform that service. And so if not enough pollen gets onto the watermelon, then you get a mal-shapen one. Or if you don't get any pollen, you don't get any watermelon at all. Some crops are entirely dependent upon pollination. Others don't require pollinators at all, such as cereal grains. Others are pollinated by the wind, such as grapes. But most of the tastiest products from plants, such as most fruits and vegetables, these require pollination for the development of the fruit or the vegetable, or at least for the propagation of the vegetable plants through seeds.
So for, I don't know, blueberries and other plants that are out there, it's really bees that are doing the work and that are critical to their reproduction.
For most of the plants that require an animal pollinator, it is bees. There are some exceptions. So there are some cactus fruits that you get as the result of the pollinating activities of nocturnal bats. And chocolate. Who doesn't like chocolate? Chocolate is brought to us by tiny little midges that nobody can really identify.
And they do the pollination. But just give us a list of some things that are bee pollinated.
Well, zucchini, all squashes, raspberries, blueberries, apples. Then there are things that can self-pollinate that don't actually need an animal to mediate the pollen, such as coffee. But when the bees are present in the coffee fields, the yield of coffee is greater because the proportion of flowers that set seed and you get coffee beans is greater when there are bees carrying pollen around. So you'd get perhaps a quarter of the amount of coffee without the bees pollinating the coffee plants, but you wouldn't get none. However, in the absence of bees, not only would we be not able to get some of our favorite fruits and vegetables, we'd get less coffee, and so people would be even grumpier in the mornings.
Okay. If there were no bees, of course, there would be certain plants that wouldn't reproduce, presumably. But these are all parts of a food chain. What might be some of the wider and longer-term impacts?
Well, plants most reproduce sexually through pollination. Flowering plants reproduce sexually through pollination. They can reproduce asexually also, but evolutionary responses, adaptations to climate change, etc., all this requires the genetic mixture that is brought about by sexual reproduction. And so immediately in the absence of bees, the effect on natural ecosystems would be that there'd be much fewer plants setting seed, many fewer nuts and berries, fewer birds, fewer bears. The whole ecosystem would be impacted at some level, and especially in the long term.
How long have the numbers of domestic honeybees been declining, and at what rate? Do we know?
Okay, there is there's a table on this in a publication by the National Academy of Sciences in the U.S., and the graph shows, I think, a halving in number of colonies kept in the USA over the previous 50 years or so. The number of colonies being kept is partly a measure of the need for honey and pollination services. So it used to be that beekeepers would earn a living by selling honey. Unfortunately, the North American market was swamped by cheap Chinese honey starting maybe a decade ago. I'm not sure of the exact time. And so most beekeepers now earn most of their income through selling the pollination services of the hives. With colony collapse disorder, there's been high death rates of colonies over winter. But the number of colonies in the wild, these are feral honeybees, has also declined dramatically. And that's largely a result of varroa mites, which are blood-sucking parasites, which beekeepers can fend off from their hives by using management practices, but the feral colonies in the great outdoors that aren't managed by people, these suffer from those, and as a result, there are almost no feral honeybees left, at least in Canada. I'm not sure of the situation in the U.S.
Let's go over a couple of those things in a little more detail. You said that most beekeepers now make their money from essentially renting out the pollinating services of their hives. Does that mean they put them on trucks, carry them into a berry field, and just say, go forth and pollinate?
In a way, yes. So in late March, I think it is just something like 96% of the honeybee colonies in the U.S. are in California for almond pollination. After that, a large proportion of them go to the southeast for high bush blueberry pollination, and then they move further north as the various tree fruit crops start developing. And so imagine a situation where you're feeding your kids nothing but almonds for 1 month, nothing but blueberries the next month, and nothing but apples the month after that. And to get from one crop to another, you've got to drive thousands of kilometers, and you've got 10,000 kids in the back all saying, are we there yet? It's not surprising that bees are somewhat stressed out. And also, you know, it's not just the transport and the diet. There's also the fact that they're exposed to a wide range of different environmental and chemical conditions in the environment when they're treated that way.
So they're really migrant farm workers.
Yes, exactly. Yeah.
Lawrence Packer's book is Keeping the Bees, Why All Bees Are at Risk, and What We Can Do to Save Them. We'll continue our conversation in just a short moment. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air, and if you're just joining us, we're speaking with biology professor Lawrence Packer. He's at York University in Toronto. His new book about bees is called Keeping the Bees, Why All Bees Are at Risk and What We Can Do to Save Them. You write about some bee parasites that have been very troubling. Let's talk about a couple of those. Tracheal mites, that's the trachea, the windpipe, right?
Yep. So insects exchange gases through little holes along the side of the body called spiracles. And these let air with high oxygen in and then let air with less oxygen in it out. These spiracles lead to a series of tubular pathways inside the body of the bee that reach into every tissue of the insect. So tracheal mites, it's a bit like having cockroaches crawling around inside your lungs and sucking on the fluids inside your body. So they're not too good for bees. It's kind of gross but entertaining to anthropomorphize this, I find.
Yeah, no, it's a vivid image that you use in the book.
Yeah.
You also write about varroa mites. That's another parasite. Tell us about them and what they do.
Yeah, these are larger, substantially larger, and they live on the outside of the bee primarily during the bee's development, and they suck the blood from the bees. So it's a bit like having a rat-sized blood sucker between your shoulder blades. You know, the bees can't reach them easily, although in a social colony they can find you can get other individuals to brush them off. That's not so much the case when the bee is developing as a larva or a pupa.
And are there treatments for these mites, and how much damage are they doing?
They were very well controlled until comparatively recently. There are various fairly simple methods that the beekeepers use to control these mites, but the varroa mite has become immune to some of the easier treatments, and now it's getting a little bit more difficult to get rid of those. Some people have claimed that the varroa mites are a major cause of the colony collapse disorder, but I think it's a part of the problem, and it's certainly a large part of why we don't have feral bees around so much. But I don't think they're the main culprit in this case.
All right. There's this phenomenon of bee colonies just declining, and it bears the name colony collapse disorder. What are some of the theories what's causing it, and what do you think?
Well, there's been a wide range of theories about this, including cell phone towers, which I gather has been ruled out. Even though I don't like cell phones, I wish it was part of the problem, because then they'd all be turned off during my lectures because the towers would be inoperative. But the main issues as far as the data I'm aware of seem to be a combination of these new systemic pesticides along with introduced diseases. It's an extremely controversial topic, but there was a survey of 800 research papers that was published just a couple of weeks ago, and it seemed to be fairly clear that from that the pesticides are at least to some extent a cause of the problem.
And how do the pesticides affect the bees? Do we know?
Most of these chemicals are used as seed coating, and they get into the plant and into the pollen and the nectar. And it seems that they have an impact on the brain, on the bees, both the immune system, making them more perceptible to the new diseases that have been brought around by people carrying bees around all over the place. But it also seems to make them less capable of finding their way home. So it's confusing them.
So we have a circumstance now where there is a declining honeybee population, and beekeepers are taking their hives around, or at least letting others take their hives around, to pollinate crops throughout the United States. Has this reached a critical point? I mean, where there just aren't enough pollinating bees?
Not in the United States yet. And worldwide, it hasn't become a problem. Certainly there are some parts of the world where, such as some parts of China, where people have to go with paintbrushes up into the trees to hand pollinate the apples to get a crop. We're not approaching that in North America, and I don't think we will. as long as we have honeybees and wild bees, which actually do a much larger proportion of the pollination than they get credit for. For example, a study in Britain showed that even if you assumed every honeybee colony was in exactly the right place at the right time throughout the year, honeybees were responsible for at most a third of the pollinator-dependent crop yield. And so wild bees and also some flies were responsible for two-thirds of it. So we really need to start paying a lot more attention to the wild bees.
Well, what's the distinction? What do we mean when we say wild species?
Well, I guess by definition, wild bees are those that we're not domesticating. So there are about 9 species of true honeybees, and at least 2 of them are actively managed. The one that's most commonly used is the Western domesticated honeybee. But they've got a second species that they use in a very similar manner in Southeast Asia and in Japan. There are other bees that people manage in the tropics. Stingless bees are managed in a fairly rustic manner by indigenous peoples in Africa quite a bit, and especially in Mexico, southern Mexico, and south into to Brazil. And then there are a few other species that we're actively domesticating, such as the alfalfa leafcutter bee, some bumblebees for greenhouse pollination, and the alkali bee and some orchard bees. But the difference between the most domesticated bees, the honeybees and the other bees, is the social life is kind of different. The way that the honeybee recruits other bees to the food resources and to a new nest, the waggle dance. Other bees don't do that. Most bees do not produce honey. Only a few hundred species of bees produce more than a teaspoon of honey. Most solitary bees just make a loaf of pollen moistened and held together with nectar, and then they lay an egg on it once they've put all that food together. So most bees are, in fact, solitary, and very comparatively few bees out of the 20,000 plus that we know exist out there will make honey at all.
Yeah, there's a fair amount of insect warfare that you write about in here. There are wasps, bee wolves, right? Bumblebee wolves and honeybee
yeah.
wolves that can kill up to 1,000 bees an hour.
Well, an aggregation of them
right,
will.
Right,
not as a single individual. In fact, in Egypt, some areas that were for honeybee keeping were wiped out by the honeybee wolf because their aggregations built up to such large numbers. They would just wait outside the hive for a worker to leave, and then they'd paralyze it, take it back, and lay an egg on it after they collected between 4 and 10 of them, and then their offspring would eat the paralyzed bee. When you paralyze your food, it stays fresh without the need for refrigeration. So that's one of the reasons that the sting evolved initially to paralyze prey for offspring.
Right.
And its defensive function is secondary.
Right. These wolves are actually wasps, right? And so
yep. they're in the group of wasps that's the most closely related to bees. So that's a little creepy.
Right. And so they paralyze the bee with the sting. The bee remains alive while the wasp's little larvae eat the bee. And can the bee feel it? Is it aware of it? Let's just get really gross here.
Yeah, I put people off. This isn't a lunch hour programmer. I'm not sure if that's known.
Okay.
Certainly you would hope that that's not the case. But some people would argue that pain and insects aren't two things that go together. But I think insects feel pain, yeah.
Okay. A couple of other exotic kinds of insects that you write about. Vulture bees. Tell us about them.
Okay, so the idea that all bees collect pollen is not quite true. There is a group of bees, they're called stingless bees. That sounds as if they're really nice and friendly, but in fact what they do, instead of stinging you, they'll use their mandibles to grab hold of a part of your eyelid or inside your ear or up your nose or your lips, and then they will vibrate their wing muscles and pinch. So they're not as nice. The idea of stingless bees sounds really cute. They're not as cute as that seems. But what these collectors for protein source is dead meat. So the workers from their social bees, the workers will go to a dead animal and they will chew away at it. And then the glandular products that result from that, that's what's fed to actually their siblings back home in the nest. Since I wrote the book, there's been a finding of an even more unusual behavior, and some other stingless bees in Southeast Asia have been shown to collect tears from vertebrates. And they use the story goes, the proteins from the antibacterial enzymes in tears as the protein source for the bee larvae. So that's pretty unusual. And the researcher who did this, Hans Banzinger in Thailand, actually had the bees feeding at his eyeballs and said that normally it didn't cause much pain, but when he had 40 bees in his eyes at once, the irritation was quite intense and lasted for quite some time.
Oh, my heavens. And they weren't stinging. They were just collecting his tears.
Yeah, they would. Well, if you've got 40 little insects walking over your eyeballs and licking at your eyelids, I think it will get irritating pretty quickly.
Wow, that's a photo that will get clicks, I imagine.
You can see pictures of this somewhere. I'm not quite sure where, but you Google eye secretion bees or tear bees, you'll probably get there eventually.
Lawrence Packer will continue his interview with Fresh Air contributor Dave Davies in the second half of the show. Packer is the author of Keeping the Bees, Why All Bees Are at Risk and What We Can Do to Save Them. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
The Neubauer Family Foundation supports WHYY's Fresh Air and its commitment to sharing ideas and encouraging meaningful conversation. Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Viking River Cruises, exploring the world in comfort, offering European cruises on Viking longships. More at vrc.com/radio. From Angie's List, connecting consumers directly to its online marketplace of services from member-reviewed local companies. More at angieslist.com. And from Stefan Edlis and Gail Neeson, in appreciation of NPR's lively coverage of culture and the arts. This is NPR.
Coming up, the fascinating story, not for the squeamish, of bees and the San Francisco oil beetle that involves larvae and bee female impersonation. More with Lawrence Packer. Also, David Bianculli reviews two new sci-fi series premiering on TV this week, Extant and The Strain, and Ken Tucker reviews the new album by country music veteran Jim Lauderdale. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Let's get back to Dave Davies' interview with biologist Lawrence Packer, author of the new book Keeping the Bees, Why All Bees Are at Risk and What We Need to Do to Save Them. When bees are threatened, it means our food supply is threatened because we depend on bees to pollinate many plants we rely on for food. Packer's new book is an exploration of bee pollination and a celebration of bee diversity.
I have to say, one of the most entertaining moments in the book is when you describe this Francisco oil beetle, a parasite that has a really wicked way of getting at bees. Tell us what it does.
Yeah, the subtitle for that is Sexually Transmitted Child-Eating Female Impersonators on a California Sand Dune. And it is a remarkable story that's been discovered by Leslie Saul and co-workers. And the California sand dune in question is the Kelso Dunes. And oil beetles eat the resources in bee nests, but the baby beetle larvae have to get into the bee nests in the first place. And what many oil beetles, meloids, do is their first instar larvae, the newly hatched from the egg, they're very active and they manage to find their way onto a bee and then get taken back to the nest that way. What the San Francisco oil beetle does is the females lay hundreds of eggs in a big mass. When these eggs hatch, they climb up anything vertical that they can find, and they sit there in a blob all together looking to something with poor eyesight like a bee. And what they do is they release a chemical mixture that is very similar to the pheromones released by the female bees to attract a male. So what happens is that the males are attracted to these hundreds of little larvae sitting on a stem, and they come into contact with it, and instantly, and you can find videos of this on the internet, and it's, I have no idea how they do it. So instantly you get from a situation where the bees approaching these larvae, and then all of a sudden there's hundreds of larvae covering its body, and the weight crashes it down to the ground. Then this bee will attempt to mate with real females. Because it's giving out these female pheromones, other male bees will think it's a female. So these little larvae attach to the females that the male mates with, and also to the males that think this male bee is a female bee. And then eventually they get back into the nest where they eat the resources there. It's a remarkably weird story. And as I say, it's a bit like going to a bar and chatting somebody attractive up and thinking that you're going to be able to enjoy their company. And then all of a sudden they turn into several hundred rat-sized parasites that you're forced to take home, and then they eat your children.
It's nasty out there, isn't it?
Yeah, but I love it.
So there are as many as 20,000 species of bees, and many of these wild bees play important roles in pollination. Tell us to what extent whether we know whether those populations are declining, and as a result, you know, we're facing a crisis, you know, of pollination and viability of these plants or crops.
Certainly, overall number of bee species you'll find in an area where we've got long-term data, the number of species seems to have declined fairly substantially. In terms of loss of individual species, that's best documented for bumblebees because they're big and furry. They're like the charismatic minor fauna. Everybody loves the bumblebee. They're so furry and brightly colored. So there's lots of data available on those. And something like 24% of the bumblebee species in Europe are heading to, you know, are on the endangered species list or heading there. And in North America, there are certainly some species which are declining or have disappeared.
You know, you write that there are many natural predators for bees. The biggest one, of course, is us human beings. Can we imagine the extinction of bees or many species of bees? How close are we to that?
I don't think all bees are at risk right now, and I don't foresee that happening in the long-term future. There are some bee populations that are increasing dramatically. So while some bumblebee species are disappearing, others are becoming more common. But what this results in is a simplified ecosystem. And it's that, you know, you don't put all your eggs in one basket type approach. The more diverse the bees are in a community, that it's likely that things are going to be working out better in the long run.
And to make the distinction here, we're talking bumblebees are wild bees. Colony collapse disorder is affecting the domesticated honeybees, right?
That's right. Right. Yeah. And so bumblebee decline started being noticed in the 1990s. And if we'd had more people looking at this at that time, we might be ahead of the game compared to where we are now in understanding the declines of all sorts of things.
You know, we talked earlier about the fact that domesticated honeybee populations are being transported around to pollinate crops and vegetables as in different parts of the country, and that that's stressful for them. And it is one of the things that's contributing to this mysterious kind of collapse of many colonies. Are we at risk of not having enough honeybees to do the pollinating that farmers expect of them?
We are at risk in the future. There was a study looking at global honeybee diversity by an Argentinian Marcelo Aizen and a Canadian Lawrence Harder, and they showed that we've not reached the point where the need for honeybees is outstripped by the resources that we need them to pollinate. But that if things don't change, it will soon reach a point where the amount of flowers we need pollinated will be greater than the bees can manage under current circumstances. So the area for growing almond trees in the U.S. Southwest, for example, is increasing dramatically, and we've already got most of the United States honeybee colonies there when the almonds are in bloom. And so, if you increase the area of almonds remarkably, it's going to be more work than the bees are going to be able to manage.
Lawrence Packer's book is Keeping the Bees: Why All Bees Are at Risk and What We Can Do to Save Them. We'll talk some more after a short break. This is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air, and if you're just joining us, we're speaking with Lawrence Packer. He's a professor of biology at York University in Toronto. His new book is Keeping the Bees: Why All Bees Are at Risk and What We Can Do to Save Them. You say that there are some things that all of us can do to help preserve pollinating bees. Among them, grow bee-friendly plants. Like what?
Well, I like raspberries for a bunch of reasons. One, I like eating raspberries. But the other two groups of reasons are that the flowers are open flowers, and just about any bee can access the pollen. And so there's quite a diversity of different bee species that will visit the raspberries in my backyard. And also the raspberry canes are perfect for a large number of stem and twig nesting bees to use as a nest site. So I leave the old raspberry canes out in my garden for years, and I've got three different genera of bees nesting in them. So in general, if you're going to plant plants for ornamentation or for food, ones with simpler open flowers are better. If you like growing roses, the wild roses, these are an open source of food. It's like a plate with the pollen in the middle, easily accessible. You look at most of the horticultural variety of roses, and it's almost impossible for a bee to burrow into the flower to try and find anything in the middle of it because all the petals were so clustered so close together. So the simpler the flower in general, the greater the diversity of bees that can use it.
So you provide a more abundant food source, you'll have a more robust bee population. You also say you can provide nest sites for bees. How you do that?
Well, I get into trouble with horticulturalists by saying this because I say you shouldn't use mulch. Most bees nest in the ground, and you wouldn't like it if somebody tipped a compost garbage truck full of compost on top of your home, and bees don't like it either. So most bees prefer sparsely vegetated soil. So lots of gardens in my neighborhood, they put wood chips or gravel or some other such stuff over the surface of the garden, or they grow a lawn. And these are pretty barren for bees. There are a few bees that will build a resin nest on stones, but they're pretty rare, and they're usually only found in deserts. There are some bees that nest in gardens, and in Europe there are whole pest control companies dedicated to removing burrowing bees from people's lawns. But in general, if you want to help the bees, have the kind of garden that your neighbors will be irritated at you for having because it looks kind of messy. The talks at the end of the talks I give on this on bees in general, I show a picture of my backyard, and I've had people stand up and shout at me, "What do I do if I want to help bees but not have a garden that looks as ugly as yours?" And I don't really know how to answer that. I like my garden.
You know, you are clearly fascinated with these animals, and there are some great descriptions of some of their exotic kind of characteristics and behavior. And, you know, there are naturalists who love – a lot of them love big mammals. I mean, it's easy to love a panda bear or a majestic lion. Do you feel affection for bees?
Oh, absolutely. Yep. Passion is a bit of an understatement. Maybe I'm obsessed, perhaps psychologically unhealthily so, but no, I'm lucky in that my wife is also a scientist. She's an ornithologist, so we got the birds and the bees between us, and nothing could be better than that. But I spend as much time as I can actually looking at bees under the microscope or out in the field studying them.
How many times do you think you've been stung?
On an average day in the field, I get stung at least once. Uh-huh. And usually it doesn't bother me. I only get bothered if I get stung in the same place more than once. Uh-huh. So sometimes I'll have a very painfully throbbing finger or thumb for hours. But usually, most bees, the sting is just enough so that you release it. They are not trying to inflict pain to keep you away from a large colony like honeybees are. They just want you to release it. And so most bee stings don't last very long, 5-10 minutes or so. But if you get stung twice in the same place, that can last a lot longer.
Lawrence Packer, thanks so much for speaking with us.
You're more than welcome. Thank you.
Lawrence Packer spoke with Fresh Air contributor Dave Davies, who is also senior reporter at WHYY. Packer's new book is called Keeping the Bees. You can read an excerpt on our website, freshair.npr.org. It seems summer is becoming the time to launch TV sci-fi shows with unusual premises, mysteries, and dangers. That's maybe thanks to last year's surprise CBS hit, Under the Dome. Tonight, CBS launches a new 13-week summer series called Extant, starring Halle Berry. And this Sunday, the FX cable network presents a creepy new series called The Strain. Our TV critic David Bianculli reviews them both.
They say every generation gets the science fiction it deserves, built around its biggest and most primal fears. Well, maybe they don't say that, but they should. In the 50s, all those movies about mutated giant monsters going berserk were a way for us to channel our fears about the atomic bomb. In the same way, in that same decade, all those body snatcher movies were about being unable to tell friend from foe or trust even your closest loved ones, the perfect paranoid parable for the communist witch-hunting era. So what are we watching this decade more than anything else? We're watching television. And on television, we seem to fear things outside of our control and dangers arriving seemingly out of the blue. In Stephen King's Under the Dome, it's a small town suddenly isolated by a mysterious force. In HBO's The Leftovers, which began last month, it's about a rapture-like event in which 2% of the world's population suddenly and mysteriously vanishes, leaving the survivors to wonder why, and more important, to wonder what to do next. And one of television's most popular series in this modern age is AMC's The Walking Dead, which imagines a world in which it's not the meek who inherit the earth, it's the zombies. And now, this week, we have two new entries in the threats from nowhere genre. Both of them are about outside forces that target us humans for a reason. In Extant, the new 13-part CBS miniseries, it's about a female astronaut who returns from an extended 13-month solo stint aboard a space station and learns that she's pregnant. But by whom or by what? And in The Strain, a new series from FX that begins Sunday, the threat is both viral and vampire. It's about the sudden outbreak of a disease that kills most of its victims, then begins to mutate them into another species entirely. Maybe all of these new TV shows have to do with our communal concerns about climate change, or destroying the environment, or spreading some unstoppable new disease. Whatever the reason, here they are. And these new ones come from very strong showbiz pedigrees. Extant, the less impressive of the two, is created by first-time TV writer-producer Mickey Fisher, but is executive produced by Steven Spielberg, who's also lent his name and expertise to Under the Dome and TNT's Alien Invasion: Falling Skies. Extant has a premise that could go places, but based on the pilot, many of those places are awfully unimpressively familiar. The moment when Halle Berry, as female astronaut Molly Watts, encounters an anomaly in space, it's while talking to her family back home and to her onboard computer when she loses the video signal. The computer isn't named Hal, as in 2001 A Space Odyssey. It's named Ben. But still.
Molly.
Go ahead.
You have an incoming VCron.
Bay 1, please.
Sending Bay 1.
The camera's on. Say hello.
Hello.
You want to tell her? Go ahead.
I got accepted into school.
I had my last meeting with the principal this morning. We're going to wait for you to get back for the arrangement.
Ben?
I'm detecting interference from a solar flare. Shall I attempt to restart after it passes?
Sure.
Attempt to restart.
Ben?
Much better, even though it treads on similarly familiar ground, is FX's The Strain. This one stars Corey Stoll, who's more than up to the demands of a leading role. In supporting parts, he played the out-of-control young congressman in Netflix's House of Cards and a memorably magnetic Ernest Hemingway in Woody Allen's Midnight in Paris. In The Strain, he plays a scientist named Ephraim Goodweather, who heads the Centers for Disease Control team called in to investigate a very bizarre airline disaster. The plane has landed safely in New York, but neither the crew nor the passengers have made a move or a sound since, and may not even be alive. When Ephraim arrives at the tarmac, a representative from another federal agency wants to board the plane first. But Ephraim talks him out of it very quickly and efficiently.
How often do you touch your face?
What?
In a day. How often?
I don't know. Once an hour?
Every 3 minutes. You have mouth-hand contact every 5 minutes. You touch somebody else every 20 minutes. That's how contagion works. You don't like terrorists? Try negotiating with a virus. A virus exists only to find a carrier and reproduce. That's all it does, and it does it quickly. It has no political views. It has no religious beliefs. It has no cultural hang-ups. And it has no respect for a badge. It has no concept of time or geography. It might as well be the Middle Ages, except for the convenience of hitching a ride on a metal tube flying from meal to meal to meal. That's how a plague begins. So you still want to be the first one through the door?
I've seen the first 4 episodes of The Strain, and they're lots of fun and effectively creepy. They give proper service to the conventions of the genre. There's even an elder Van Helsing type who knows how to hunt down and kill these nasty, no longer human bloodsuckers. But there's also a lot of the inventive visual flair and strong characterization that made the movie Alien so frightening and compelling back in the 70s. The secret weapon of The Strain is Guillermo del Toro, whose flashy, visceral genre movies include Hellboy, Pan's Labyrinth, and Pacific Rim. With series co-creator Chuck Hogan, del Toro wrote the original novels on which The Strain is based, and del Toro directed the first episode of the TV series. Del Toro's love of special effects and genuine scares, and his delight in mixing humor and horror, runs throughout The Strain. And its showrunner is Carlton Cuse, who was head writer with Damon Lindelof on the ABC series Lost. Both of them have wound up working on new novelistic genre TV mysteries this summer. Lindelof on The Leftovers and Cuse on The Strain. The Strain, by far, is the best of the new batch.
David Bianculli is founder and editor of the website TV Worth Watching and teaches TV and film history at Rowan University in New Jersey. Coming up, rock critic Ken Tucker reviews Jim Lauderdale's new album, This Is Fresh Air.
Thank you.
This is Fresh Air. Jim Lauderdale has a new album called I'm a Song. The title suggests his deep immersion in songwriting. His compositions have been covered by singers ranging from George Strait to Solomon Burke, from the Dixie Chicks to Elvis Costello. Since his debut album in 1991, he's recorded more than 25 albums, and I'm a Song contains a generous 20 songs. Rock critic Ken Tucker says Lauderdale's career is at once admirable and somewhat puzzling. Here's his review.
Hello, my name is Mr. Sunshine. I've been away until you smile. You gave me something I will treasure. Let's have a good thing together.
Jim Lauderdale has a great voice for honky-tonk music, a plummy tone that lopes along beside the genre's strong rhythms. On most Lauderdale songs, you can hear the wide smile he flashes so frequently on stage. He's a naturally cheerful fellow, at least in his public presentation, which hasn't stopped him from composing one of the most durable sad songs of the past few decades.
The king of broken hearts doesn't ask much from his friends, and he has quite a few of them. They know he will understand. That's just the way it goes. The king of broken hearts doesn't know he's a king. He's trying to forget other things, like some old chilly scene. He's walking through alone. He talks to angels and the stars start to spin. He thinks of trouble.
That's The King of Broken Hearts, a song that first surfaced on Lauderdale's 1991 debut album Planet of Love, co-produced by Rodney Crowell and John Leventhal. The song, written in homage to George Jones and sung by Lauderdale in Jones's trademark clenched jaw style, has been a consistent crowd pleaser right from the start. Lauderdale said recently that since Planet of Love is now out of print, he wanted to re-record it for this new album, for a hopefully new raft of fans. The song holds up. So, it seems to me, will newer ones, like this one, Today I've Got the Yesterdays, featuring harmonies with Patti Loveless.
Today I've got the yesterdays. They took me to another place. Just visiting what's gone away. Today I've got the yesterdays. Being sentimental, sometimes it will send you back. Another return visit, know how much I miss it. To have what we had.
So with all these good songs and strong singing, why isn't Lauderdale a bigger star? I think one answer is the absence of a consistent persona in his work. Look at his idols. George Jones is, in Jim's phrase, the king of broken hearts. Graham Parsons is the sensitive tragic hero that Lauderdale is too optimistic and too wise to the ways of the music biz to emulate. Bluegrass legend Ralph Stanley, with whom Lauderdale recorded a Grammy-winning album, is the kind of formalist that Jim never aspired to be. Lauderdale rarely goes as bleakly dark as his pal Buddy Miller can, both on guitar and in lyrics with his wife Julie Miller. One reason Lauderdale is a successful songwriter for others is because he can slip into others' skins and write from different points of view and moods. On his own projects and on the satellite radio show he co-hosts with Buddy Miller, he projects a sunniness that to some listeners may come across as lightweight. But it takes as much craft to sound resilient as it does to sound shattered and depressed. Listen to the way he adroitly bounces back from a wrecked romance on a song like I Lost You.
I lost you. I've lost you. You've slipped from nothing I can do, because I've lost you. Just like a rich man.
With its Whitman-esque title, I'm a Song, its 20 songs and collaborators including Elvis Costello, Grateful Dead lyricist Robert Hunter, and the great country rock steel guitar player Al Perkins, this album has the heft of as major a statement as Jim Lauderdale has ever made. That it also proceeds through 20 songs with such speedy ease suggests just what a satisfyingly deep lightweight Lauderdale has become.
Ken Tucker reviewed Jim Lauderdale's new album called I'm a Song. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our technical director and engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Our associate producer for online media is Molly C.V. Nesper. Roberto Shorrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Saturday night, it's the end of the world. Sitting around with our flags unfurled, walking the dogs and feeding the cat. No matter what happens, can't forget about that. What do you know? It's the end of the world. The very thought makes my whiskers curl. Reading the paper, baby, checking the news. Hold up for a moment, gotta read the reviews. It's the end of the world.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Progressive Insurance, helping people shop for car insurance at 1-800-PROGRESSIVE and progressive.com. From the George Lucas Educational Foundation, creator of Edutopia, a source for what works in education. Learn more at edutopia.org. And from the Lemelson Foundation, supporting inventors and invention to improve lives in the U.S. and developing countries. On the web at lemelson.org. This is NPR.
The new film Boyhood shows a 6-year-old boy and his older sister actually grow up. It's not a documentary, but a fiction film shot over the period of 12 years. On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Richard Linklater, who wrote and directed the film. His other movies include Slacker, Dazed and Confused, School of Rock, Before Sunrise, and Bernie. Join us.